This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there, listeners in Radioland. Tonight you're in for a special occasion.
Every couple of years, we spend time with Robert Fanny. Robert has gone through multiple evolutions, and that continues. He is a respected science fiction writer. He has worked for the premier defense analyst, Janes, as a risk analyst. That helps. Robert Scribbler's blog became a home base for an active group of climate watchers. Lately, Fanny has moved to video blogging on climate and then just newly brought out his interests in clean tech and electric transportation. So it's definitely time for an update. Robert Marston Fanny, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be back. You're always good to have a discussion with you.
Yeah, I talk to you every couple of years. I was looking at it. It was 2013, and
I have a confession to make. We are in trouble, and we're worse lately, but hey.
One of our most popular shows, actually. We still get downloads of that program, so it's still alive.
Wow.
And then we talked again 2015 and 2017, so now it's 2019. It's time to go again. Why did you move from your really popular online blog to more a video format?
So with the blog itself worked well, but what I found was that I was only reaching a certain group. And don't get me wrong, I think it's important to communicate with the climate community itself and to refine messaging through that. But I wanted to try to break out a bit to younger people in social media and the younger generation in general. And YouTube tends to be a better avenue for that kind of audience. So I thought I'd try a different format to try and reach a different audience and provide good basic information on the issue of climate change and clean energy as well. Now, the YouTube has worked out pretty well. I don't think I've had any kind of major breakout moment, but most of the videos end up getting between like 1,000 and 5,000 views, so it does okay.
All right, so let's begin with your mid-April climate update. The title is Present Climate Indicators and the Uncertain Potential for a Record Warm 2019. What are some of the indicators you're looking at? And I'm going to sit back in my chair and let you go forth, Robert.
So at present, what we're looking at is right now in the Pacific, we're experiencing a weak El Nino. And what that means is that the natural variability scale is tipping more toward the warm side of natural variability. Those who follow El Nino note that there's a fluctuation in global temperature of a range of about 0.5 degrees Celsius on the warm end. So if you have a relatively strong El Nino, you get about a 0.5 degrees Celsius bump. And if there's a strong La Nina, which is the cool phase of the El Nino-La Nina cycle, then you can get as much as a 0.5 degrees Celsius negative departure from a typical climatological baseline. Right now, the weak El Nino is kind of loading the dice for warmer months. And so what we may tend to see over the coming months are challenges to the record warmth that we saw during 2016. Now, since El Nino right now is kind of weak and we haven't moved very far from 2016 in the temporal range, it's a little less likely that we'll see major departures on the record hot side, but I think it's probably likely that we'll see at least a few months of the coming months be new record warm months. And so far for 2019, we're about third hottest on record, and I think that the movement will tend to be more toward first or second, and with a possibility of exceeding 2016. But I'd like to put a little asterisk there. Because the El Nino is weak, we might not exceed 2016, even though we're presently on the warm side of natural variability. And even though we've added a significant volume of greenhouse gases between the last El Nino and now. So you might start to hear some of the climate naysayers start talking about, oh, well, you know, it hasn't warmed since 2016. and that was a big meme with the super El Nino that we had way back in 1998 and for a long time some of the climate change naysayers were pointing at that as a bit of a cherry pick to try and sow some confusion about the global climate system. But in general, we're still warming by about 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. That warming rate may have accelerated, but we don't have yet enough information to really determine whether or not we're seeing an acceleration. Although recent years have been really warm in comparison with baseline climatological averages, the point to really note though is that the science has been so far extraordinarily accurate when it comes to predicting temperature increase. And so the models, say, for example, back in the late 1990s and early 2000s have nailed it so far. So a lot of validation of earlier climate science. And there's both reasons for hope and consternation because of that. It's kind of like, well, okay, the science looks like it's been mostly right, at least when it comes to temperature. The scientists are saying some freaky things, but you know, we're not in like extraordinary, much worse than usual territory, at least when it comes to temperature. Now there's some other parameters of global climate change that do look worse than normal, but with regards to temperature, we're about on track to what the scientists expected. Now that's not happy or hopeful overall, because climate change in general, if you keep warming the way we're warming, really cleans your clock. But it is reassuring to me to see those global climate model predictions on temperature being borne out in present trends.
I think one of the crushers for me, Robert, was when we learned that emissions had gone up again this past year. I somehow got the idea that, well, maybe we'd reached peak emissions and, yeah, we're still adding tons and megatons and it will still get worse, but at least we've kind of crested. But oh no, we're still expanding the danger, and that one was very dispiriting for me.
So what's happening right now is what appears to be happening with regards to trend lines is that we had a major growth in carbon emissions coming from China, and China started to clean up its act a little bit and get in with the rest of the world, like with the rest of the industrialized world, in the sense that they were deploying more cleaner energy and working more toward efficiencies. And so in the 2012 to like 2016, 2017 timeframe, that had a rather positive impact on the rate of emissions growth, meaning that positive in the sense of more optimistic, that there started to be marginal drops in the annual rate of emissions growth. But since that time, what seems to have happened is that the growth engine for fossil fuel burning in India seems to have ramped up. So we're getting more coal production now in India. And the rate of drawback in China, you know, has slowed down, and there may have been a bump up as well. So what we're seeing now, like you said, is that the climate emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions, are unfortunately still increasing. Although if you look at the trend line, the rate of increase is slower than it had been, say, for example, in the 2000s and the early portion, like 2010, 2011, for example. So we didn't plateau. We didn't hit peak. If we had hit peak, it would have been an early peak, and it would have given us more of an opportunity to start to avoid potentially hitting the 2 degrees Celsius. It would have given us more of a window for avoiding that level of warming. And it would have given us much more of a window for the really hard turn, which would have been around 1.5. That window right now is rapidly closing. And I think there's a pretty strong consensus that we need to start having a net emissions decline within the next 12 years. And in my opinion, being a little bit on the cautious side, I think we just need to do it as soon as possible. 12 years sounds too long for me. So what I am hoping to see is that, you know, efficiency and clean energy tend to move forward more rapidly and start to cut into those carbon emissions more. But right now, when it comes to policy posture, we have a bit of a backlash. And so whenever you get that kind of backlash, and we're seeing it now, you tend to have backsliding. And unfortunately, at the top level, at the government leadership level, in many of the governments, The policies are not really coming online to even meet the Paris goals, which are the initial goals of the Paris Agreement, which probably would have put us on track for around 3 degrees Celsius or more this century. So that's the present state. I don't think everything is a moving target, in my opinion. So I don't think we're set in stone with regards to that state. But needless to say, you know, we are limiting our options by continuing to increase the volume of greenhouse gases that hit the atmosphere each year. And right now, we really do have a number of tools that we could use to bend that curve down. We're not as locked into fossil fuel burning as an economic engine as we used to be.
You know, I really appreciate you covering in your recent video the double tropical cyclones that struck East Africa. Not enough people are paying attention to that. That is really a big story. And a city in Mozambique was obliterated. But you ask, is that really the first city wiped out by climate-enhanced disasters? What do you think?
Well, I honestly don't. I mean, so we had the Fort McMurray fires, and now Fort McMurray wasn't completely wiped out, but it did force all of Fort McMurray in Canada, which ironically is also a tar sands production center, to evacuate. And that's around 150,000 people. That city itself could have been wiped out if those wildfires had not been contained to the extent that they were. And in addition, if some of those, some of the falling debris had actually really caught on in the city and wiped out more neighborhoods. Also in California, we have seen large wildfires enhanced by human caused climate change wipe out whole towns. And a number of people living in these towns in the range of 20 to 30,000 people. So, I mean, yeah, that's not like a full city, but even so, you're still talking about very large communities. Katrina wrecked New Orleans considerably. New Orleans wasn't wiped out. A good number of buildings were destroyed, though. So I mean, my contention is that we have been seeing city-threatening extreme events occurring. And this particular city in Mozambique, which lost, I think, something along the lines of 100,000 structures, was not the first such event where we saw mass structure loss due to climate change. Maybe if you're drawing a very fine line, you could contextualize it as the first major city wiped out by this kind of event. But I think we've seen this kind of trend becoming something that is more frequent, where we're seeing more extreme weather events, more extreme wildfires that do threaten cities. And that's one of the aspects of human-caused climate change risk that ramps up as you get into these higher levels of warming. And so right now we're at about 1.1 degrees Celsius above 1880's baseline. And of course, people argue about where we should put the baseline, but that's generally where NASA puts the baseline. And in that range, I mean, we are starting to see a multiplication of extreme weather events and worsening wildfires and worsening droughts that threaten the function and structural integrity of cities around the world. So we're already facing a serious challenge when it comes to climate change, and this is the early stuff. So,
but you know, I didn't have Mozambique and Malawi in my list of climate danger zones, but now it seems almost anywhere in the world is a climate danger zone. Are there still safe places to go?
I don't think there's any place in the world where you can go where you can completely avoid an enhanced climate risk. I mean, what climate change does to the atmosphere is you're increasing the rate of evaporation and precipitation by about 8% on each end of the hydrological cycle for each 1 degree Celsius of warming. Evaporation is a part of the storm engine. So one of the things that causes storms to rapidly intensify is evaporation from the surface of the land, forming a parcel of air that is much warmer than the surrounding air, and so it rises much faster, and that's called convective available potential energy. And so if you increase the net rate of evaporation around the world by 8%, you're providing more opportunity for rapidly rising portions of air, rapidly rising columns of air to feed into these storms. And for the storms to rapidly intensify and hit a peak intensity that's beyond what we would typically see for that region. So then that's just one aspect. You know, the evaporation engine is also an engine that drives drought. Rapid evaporation drives rapid drying of foliage, which leads to more wildfire risk. So you start to add those new parameters, and you're really looking at an increased risk for all of these kinds of events around the world. And you start to add in sea level rise. I mean, many cities around the world are very close to a coast. You start to add in some of the concerns with regard to water scarcity. And if your rains are coming more intensely in shorter periods of time, then it's much more difficult to manage the water. So that there's a major engineering challenge and a major societal challenge when it comes to managing water for certain regions. And when you start to look at the whole globe, you're like, where is it where there's not an issue with potential water scarcity, where there's not an ocean that could rise, where there's not a potential for drought that's being enhanced, or a potential for various storms that are nearby that are being enhanced by, say, for example, warming ocean surface waters or more intense evaporation from landforms. And you really kind of draw a blank. If you're living on the Earth, you're living under a generally increased risk of extreme events due to what we've done to both the atmosphere and the oceans and the Earth system as a whole.
Yeah, I thought we were moving to a relatively safe place where we could grow some of our own food and so on. And we've had fire emergencies the last two summers, and the place has been filled with smoke, and we're always ready to pack and go. So, you know, and even if you are in a place that's perceived to be safe by too many people, you can expect a lot of company as people flood over to where you are. So there's even a danger to being seen as a safe place.
Well, I mean, I think that in general that we as humankind need to be certainly more welcoming of our fellows. One of the destabilizing influences globally is migration itself can be a trigger for destabilization, but the reason why it's a trigger for destabilization is generally a societal or intrinsic cultural fear of others. And a fear that we don't have enough to go around, so we can't share, and we shouldn't be welcoming these other people where we are, and so we're going to build some walls or say, no, you can't live here. And the people who are forced out, you know, become antagonistic, and so you end up with conflict over what is perceived to be scarce resources. Now, don't get me wrong, resource scarcity is a real issue, but you generally have more to go around than people tend to perceive. The perception of scarcity, it usually is well in advance of actual scarcity. And so when it comes to climate change, in order to prevent oppressive regimes and ways of dealing with people that end up just being downright terrible, which are also destabilizing, which tend to support dictatorial and authoritarian states that are not good for anybody, you tend to have to help to inform a greater level of acceptance of your fellow man. Where many of us are going to be on the move in the next few decades. And we need to figure out a way to share and help each other if we're going to make it through together without living in an age of conflict. And really, that's something that we want to really, really, really work to avoid, because we make it much worse if we start fighting each other.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is author, blogger, and now video blogger Robert Marston Fanny. I totally agree about this possible surge of immigration cross-country. I mean, people in Bangladesh, probably about 100 million people are going to have to move somewhere, whether it's to China or to India or they're going to have to go. But also, as you've pointed out already, we're going to have internal refugees like we had from Katrina. People spread all over the United States after Katrina, and many of them are still living in other cities like Denver and in the Carolinas. That's going to happen. Well, look, Miami's going to have to be abandoned sooner or later, and large parts of Florida are going to flood with storm surges. We're going to have all kinds of reasons why within America and within Europe and within Australia, there are going to be climate refugees. And if we can develop a culture of welcoming the traveler and building with newcomers, maybe we'll survive that.
I always thought that climate change was more of a risk. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, climate change itself is rough. I mean, the damage, the potential damage to infrastructure and to societies just by itself, and the cost of dealing with it is monumental and worse than facing multiple world conflicts if you are on a business as usual fossil fuel burning scenario, something in the range of potentially as much as $20 trillion worth of damage per year by the end of this century. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, I mean, climate change in itself is really an engine of devastation. And the worst case scenario looks like it is a civilization crashing engine by itself. But we can crash ourselves. And the way we crash ourselves is by giving into fear. And that can come ahead of the worst impacts of climate change. So managing climate change involves a movement by society to face it in a rational and calm fashion and in a way that is as helpful and as sharing as possible. And I know that's a really hard message to individualistic Western societies, particularly the U.S., where we tend to teach the lesson of, you know, excel on your own and be great on your own, and you can do it all yourself. And if you do, you'll be rich and be a billionaire and all that stuff. The incentives for our system right now are a little bit out of whack with what the crisis looks like. And it's understandable why there's a great degree of consternation and cognitive dissonance, because unfortunately, the crisis we face kind of forces us to change in a way that is difficult for us. It's outside of our context. But we need to try to change in that way if we're going to make it through.
You know, I'm less optimistic than you sound so far. Myself, I'm seeing predictions that parts of the Middle East, of Asia, and the tropics generally will become too hot for humans. And just like the fish, the plants, and the birds, I think within a century, humans will begin the trek towards the cooler poles. And I'm wondering, Robert Fanny, calling on your science fiction imagination, can you see that happening? What would it look like?
Well, I mean, a disaster scenario is actually really not very difficult to imagine. And I'm, in all honesty, I'm not sure if I want to go into detail as to what that looks like. But to paint it with a broad brush, you end up with a collapse. First, a collapse of the societies that are in the equatorial regions with that poleward migration. And unfortunately, we already see a bit of that signal now. If you look at the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, going back to 2013 and 2012, most of the previous years, the primary cause of migration and displacement for the globe was political conflict, war, that kind of thing. And by 2013, most of the years following 2013, the primary driver of migration and displacement changed to natural disasters in the forms of heat waves and extreme weather events and extreme rainfall and floods. And if you look at the regions of the world that were most heavily impacted, they tended to be those regions in the equatorial zones. So we kind of see a little bit of it now, but as that intensifies, those societies, unless they manage to transform in a way that's almost like living on Antarctica or on the moon, unless they are somehow able to internalize their agriculture and live mostly in five in climate-controlled environments, which is going to be highly energy-intensive if they manage to do that, then you end up with, you know, as first mass poverty, mass dislocation, mass loss of ways of sustaining life and livelihood, and then the movement of those people to regions where there is a perception that life and livelihood can be sustained. And then following that, just the emergence of a kind of desert in that region, in the zone near, you know, Africa and the Middle East and India, likely, and as well as a zone in the tropics where it becomes really, really difficult to maintain societies just because the hurricanes become so strong. If you have storms that are Irma strength, for example, striking the Caribbean every 3 to 5 years, how many times can you rebuild St. Martin? How many times can you completely rebuild St. Thomas? So So the early phase of that is, you know, mass destruction by storms and heat waves and droughts, forcing people to move out of those zones or suffer serious damage at an increasing tempo. And then once people move into the more temperate latitude zones, then those regions themselves start to suffer similar consequences. So it's kind of a phased movement, unless society becomes so resilient that they can deal with, like, somehow engineer a way to manage such an extreme level of environmental destruction. But I mean, that seems like a rather high bar for me. That seems like a very high cost and a very high level of organization in order to confront that kind of severe crisis. Now, my opinion is that we can still avoid the worst case scenarios of climate change, and that we can turn away from the high levels of fossil fuel burning that were predicted for the 20th century. And to a certain degree, we've done a little bit of that, but we haven't done enough of the work to avoid the kind of scenario that I'm describing, at least for the equatorial regions of the world. So a 3 degrees Celsius warming world does include that kind of scenario. And that's the present pathway is for about 3 to 4. So that's the scenario that Dr. Michael Mann described as like a hot house Earth kind of scenario. In my opinion, that's not the hot house, but that's bad. I mean, that's really bad. So we don't want to live through that. I think we can avoid it, but we have to work hard to do that.
I'm starting to wonder if imagination is what might do us in, the lack of imagination, because we can barely think about living without flying or driving, without our fossil-based machine slaves. Apparently, we can't imagine a future that's really different. And maybe it's simpler, maybe it will be better, maybe harder. Could lack of imagination be the block to climate action by masses of people?
So I think that's a fantastic question. And you know, I think many of us have envisioned different futures, in all honesty. When you talk about imagination, it's more about, in my opinion, what people buy into and the flexibility or lack thereof of their future vision. So, for example, we have an environmental movement that has wisely said, well, we can live lightly on the earth. We can do less and we can be happy, and we don't have to have all these things. And many of the people on the earth have returned and said, we want these things, and we want them for a number of different reasons. So, and if you look at Puerto Rico and what occurred after Maria, you begin to understand that there's a little bit of a reason why people want to live in a society with electricity and mechanization, because, you know, if you don't have at least a basic level of that, you do end up losing more lives. So there is a little bit of a very real safety issue with a power down kind of scenario. Now, it's not to say that the message of living lightly and trying to unplug from the mass technology and use the technology that we have much more efficiently is a bad message. I think that, in my personal opinion, I think that's the part of any solution. At the very least, you want technology that really lightens the load. But at the same time, there is a little bit of a fear factor and a desire factor as well that keeps people kind of clinging to that tech and to those systems. And so on the other side, I think you need to imagine ways of providing that same level of safety and comfort with systems that are not based on carbon emissions, that you start to plug in the more sustainable systems as well. And I think it's the synergy between those two ways of thinking. It's not an or other kind of thing. I think it's a both kind of thing that allows you to move forward with imagining a livable future. Now, I think there's all sorts of different ways. And I think that engaging the problem-solving nature of humankind rather than the withdrawal and the kind of pulling into my shell and defending my particular turf, my little piece of land, be it, you know, in, you know, what the way I see the world or where I live, it is really the way to go. I think that we need to reach out and say, look at the things that we can do. Look at the things that we have done in the past. Yes, I mean, humans are not a perfect creature, but what is? One of our strengths is problem solving. How do we engage that problem solving in a positive way? And I think that that's where imagination really starts to move forward, because you start to look at a problem and you start asking the question, how can I solve this? How can I fix this? What are my pathways for, you know, making my life and the lives of my children better and more likely to be sustained over the long term? Because this is what we're facing. We're facing a long-term crisis that with each turn of the ratchet, it gets worse. It causes more pain and more hurt and more dislocation and more damage. And we really, in a way, it kind of forces us either to fight in a constructive fashion or to flee. And I think that we need to learn to fight in a constructive fashion and engage our problem-solving nature in an imaginative way. And we've seen some of that. We've seen some of that from innovators, and that, to me, is a positive outcome. And we've also seen the not positive stuff as well. So the world is still a mixture of light and darkness.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Still a mixture of light and darkness. So in the meantime, Robert Marston Fanny, we have to try to modify our heavy carbon lives, and I think it's time for that conversation that I have been avoiding on this show, electric car chatter, because I have been dubious about that transition, but now I'm kind of coming around. I've got myself an electric bike that a listener donated to me, and thank you, Dana. And I've got neighbors who are starting to buy electric cars, and they're coming over to my place and say, what are you doing with that gas guzzler? So, Robert, you recently took another revolution in your video blogs to investigate electric cars. How did that come about?
So, I you know, as a writer, I don't make a huge amount of money. And if I'm going to, like, transform myself personally, I am going to need to invest in some clean energy as well. Now, at present, I live relatively lightly. I live in a condo. It's a one-bedroom condo. My wife and I, we're both vegans. And in the past, we shared one automobile, which is, you know, overall, our carbon footprint is considerably less than, I guess, what your typical person living in Western culture, you know, produces as far as, like, an annual common carbon emission. However, because we are still plugged into the grid, which is still primarily fossil fuels, and because we still drive a vehicle that still burns gasoline, our carbon footprint is more than it could be. So I started to think about, well, how can I, as a person, get to net zero carbon emissions myself? So the Paris Climate Agreement is really all about trying to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And in my opinion, we probably need to be closer to the present than 2050, but hey, you know, it's better to have a goal and that we're working towards, and one that we can hopefully increase our ambition for over time, than not having a goal at all. And so for me, I was like, okay, I want to be net zero individually by around 2025. Now that's really ambitious, right? But I started to look at what I needed to do that, and part of it involves changing my transportation and changing where my energy for my home comes from. And those are heavy lifts there, meaning that takes out a big chunk of the present carbon emission. Now, to offset, my idea was then to try and share the clean energy with other people. And I began to think of, well, how can I do that? And I began looking at electric vehicles. Now, an electric vehicle in general, like for the U.S. population, will, if it's plugged into a grid like here in Maryland, will tend to reduce your carbon emission by about 2 tons per year if you drive an average of 10,000 miles a year. And that's carbon emissions in use. So that's a pretty substantial reduction. If you plug it into a solar panel or a wind turbine, you can almost double that. So that's a pretty decent reduction. So back in the fall, I said, well, you know what? I am going to do what I can to get an electric vehicle as this first phase. And I looked at ride sharing. So I started driving for Uber in my spare time to make money to buy an electric vehicle, because these things aren't cheap. A highly capable electric vehicle costs about $35,000 to $40,000. And even with a government incentive, that's still a big stretch for someone on my kind of income. So I started Ubering, and I started saving the money, setting it aside. And it was kind of nice because I got to have conversations with people as I was driving about climate change. So it gave me actually access to another group of people. People are just, you know, working in the DC area, and it was very eclectic and it was very enlightening to me. And I got to learn a lot about people's individual challenges as well and thoughts on the issue of climate change as I was doing it. And I did it for 6 months and I saved some money. And so I just recently purchased a Tesla Model 3, which I am now ride sharing with others. And so I am sharing a clean energy platform with people in my community. And the next step for me is to get some home solar panels, power that vehicle with those home solar panels, and to multiply my clean energy impact by continuing to share it. So that's my journey so far with regards to some individual actions and my plan for the future.
All right. I'd like to tell you about a case here in a rural zone, and I think this would apply to some people in the suburbs, too, that my friends Kevin and Lane bought the equivalent of a small electric tractor. It's really a modified commercial-grade lawnmower, but it can pull carts full of hay and many more things for them. And then they bought a Tesla. They bought it on time, and they think it's going to work out for them. One thing Kevin has found is that he can sleep in the back of his Tesla 3. There's enough room when you fold down the back seat going back into that big spacious trunk that he can stretch out there, full-size guy. And it helps that the car also has an inbuilt small heater to keep the batteries at their correct operating temperature. And that actually heats the floor a bit if he sleeps there in a winter sleeping bag while the car is recharging if he's traveling a longer distance. He goes to a supercharger that he finds on his app on his phone, and he's all set up for that. So their next project is to build a solar power charging station at their farm for all that equipment, and then they're going to be kind of off-grid for a lot of their traveling.
And that sounds fantastic. And if they're organically producing their food, then they are also helping to offset carbon through a land use change that is actually going to sequester more carbon than it otherwise would. So that sounds like a fantastic sustainability schedule and plan. And I'd just like to add that with regards to the Tesla, so the one that I have, the Model 3, has a glass roof, and it's just very immersive. It's the feeling that I have while driving it is completely different than the feeling that I get when I drive an internal combustion engine, which has its own noise that's in the vehicle. I mean, the vehicle itself it kind of moves like a piece of the wind. It just kind of drifts along. It just whoosh, makes a whooshing sound. And everything around me, I can see through the windows and the roof. And as it rains, I can see that. And I could see sleeping in it because you can put down the seats in the back and just lay down. And if you did that, you could just look up through the glass and see the sky. And it's just, I don't know, it's the way it's been engineered is very intrinsic. It makes you feel like you're really more a part of the world. And I honestly think that Tesla itself has taken very seriously the notion of its mission to help fight climate change by being an all clean energy company and producing a kind of product that is more in touch. Now, of course, machines are completely, you know, not natural, but if we can move our machinery closer to nature in a way that is more complementary of nature and gives back rather than just taking, then I think we've taken one of the steps that we need to along our path of sustainability. And I think that if we have that vision of continuing to move our technology to a more natural form of process, a more natural way of doing things, then I think that there is hope for us as a species. So it's not to say that the tech that we have now, even the clean tech, is the perfect. You know, but I see it as a large movement away from the highly destructive technology of the past. And I mean, and even if you look at the electric engines in a Tesla Model 3, you're talking about times three or times two and a half efficiency gain versus a base internal combustion engine in and of itself. So it is a lighter form of tech when it comes to externality. And it's not to say that there aren't any externalities. Any kind of process like that that's going to produce something with metal and glass and all those various materials, it's going to have an externality. But looking at the systemic nature of that kind of energy system versus an internal combustion engine, and you're cutting your externalities down considerably, not just for carbon emissions, but also for materials use and that kind of thing.
And the next big challenge, I mean, here in Canada, the best-selling vehicles are pickup trucks. And in the United States, they're pretty high up to the point where GM has practically said, well, we're not going to make cars anymore, which I think is a terrible backsliding step. But we're going heavier metal. And I know why people want them. Most people that buy them don't actually need them, but I do. I haul manure, I haul gravel, I haul wood. We heat with wood here, and that's one way we avoid a lot of carbon emissions. So I don't have to use the truck often, but I kind of need one to live cheap in the country. I noticed that Ford has announced they're going to make an electric Ford 150, their top-selling model. We've got the Rivian, but that's pretty pricey. It's billed as a luxury adventure vehicle. GM's talking about it, but they haven't done anything. Tesla has shown a model of a pickup that they're making. They're dubbing it the Cyberpunk. I think that we're going to have to do something there to at least pick up people for the next 10, 15 years into the electric transportation scene. And then we have to lighten it up and lighten it up. I mean, electric bicycles are really a good idea.
They're amazing. Yeah.
I can carry a lot of stuff, 180 pounds on this cargo bike. And of course, the amount of power and the materials and the externalities, as you say, that goes into those is tiny.
Yeah, no, there's a good reason for the sustainability community to be in love with bicycles, both manually operated and electric. They are amazing machines, they're very elegant, and I think certainly right size for, it's just a good metaphor for society in general. A person on a bicycle, powering it with muscle power or a few batteries and getting where they need to go just as efficiently as possible. Whenever I see someone on a bike, it does make me happy. I do understand why some people can't use them. I mean, some people don't have the athleticism to ride a regular bike, and so the electric bike does kind of fill the gap for that. But with regards to your talk about the pickup truck, which has kind of become, or the SUV, which has kind of become a symbol of, I don't know what, but for American culture, people feel like if they have one of these giant pieces of metal, then they've made it. And so there's such a high demand for it. I absolutely agree. We need to look at electrifying those. And I think that there would be a big gain from the standpoint of reduced carbon emissions. Certainly not as much as if you built in the buses and the trucks. But if you do all of that, then you really are starting to work on that culture. And if you get some of those people who like pickup trucks and like SUVs into electric vehicle, and they're like, whoa, look at this torque. I can really pull a stump with this vehicle, and this is really neat. I can use my tools just by plugging into this truck, and I can have enough power all day. Or if you have a house that's out in the country and you lose power because your power line is, strung way out, and you can have a two-way system where you plug your home into the truck because the truck has a 100 kilowatt battery, which can power your house for a week in the event of a powerful storm. Then the utility of that kind of a platform becomes a real opening, I think, for people to start to think more sustainably and not be so, reactionary and feeling like, those of us who are environmentalists are trying to impose on them.
Yeah, President Trump says we're trying to take away your pickup trucks, but we're not. We're just trying to change them. But the other thing that you just brought up is that if we can use all these distributed vehicle batteries as a big pool. So when they're parked, they're still getting charged somehow by renewable energy and building up. And then when they're sitting there at night unused, and that's when you need your electric power, you can draw back out of them. That could be part of our grid. Your car could be part of the grid.
Yeah, that's the vehicle to grid has been something that sustainability advocates have been talking for a long time. If you have this massive distributed storage that you can then plug into the grid, it really does help balance out the intermittency of wind and solar. And that's one of the things, if you're buying into an electric vehicle, you're buying into the potential for that kind of storage. And even now, you already are, because what happens is when you are done with your battery for your electric vehicle, that battery goes right back to the manufacturer. They slap a metal case around it, and they check which cells were bad. They pull those cells out, and then they sell it to a power company as a storage system. So that infrastructure that produces those batteries is helping to make wind and solar power more attainable, more usable, and more ubiquitous.
Radio EcoShock.
As a climate broadcaster, I'd like to be on the cutting edge of all this, but the fact is I will probably get an electric vehicle after a lot of other people because I'm poor. Now, I had thought about the solution that you made to do Uber and ride sharing, and that's a great idea for a lot of our listeners. I know I'm going to have to buy a used vehicle, and it'll take a little time till there's enough used ones available at that price point, and I guess a lot of us are in that situation too.
I think making that leap is an investment, and it's difficult, and it's something that presents challenges. My particular solution is probably more usable and more available for people who are living in urban environments. So, of course, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's just I engage my own, like, problem-solving. What can I do in my situation to gain access to this clean energy? And I think that people across the world, like you, are confronting a similar problem. Just as an example, in the Ukraine, for some reason, the Nissan Leafs, the older Nissan Leafs, are really popular. They have this major market for purchasing these old used Nissan Leafs, and the batteries might not be in great shape, but they don't care if the range has been knocked down to, say, for example, 70 miles or whatnot. For some reason, folks in the Ukraine are really, really working hard to get access to an electric vehicle of any kind, and it's very useful for their society where they are. They might not have to drive as far, say, for example, as someone who's living in the continental North America region. So I think where you are, you know, your given context may provide you with options that are not available to me, and my context, you know, might provide me with some options that might not be available to some other people. But I think that if we look at our context and we look at what our needs are and what our costs are, we might be able to creatively start to find a way to gain access. And I'm not saying that's true in all cases, but I think that there tends to be some more possibility there than we initially might think. I know for me, I was looking at Tesla Model 3 and the more advanced long-range electric vehicles and saying, that's still too expensive with me. I need to figure out a way to break the box here a little bit and you know, get outside of my typical comfort zone and try and meet it halfway.
You know, about, 7 years ago at least, maybe more, I recorded a talk about a book called Transpo Revolution, which was two professors arguing that our whole society has to transform to electric transportation and electricity in general. And one of the arguments that they brought out is, well, people will say most electric cars in America are still powered by natural gas or even coal, so you shouldn't buy them. But in fact, electric allows you to substitute cleaner and cleaner sources of electricity as we go along, and gas-powered cars can't do that. They are directly tied to the tar sands, to dirty energy. And we get a big cut in the pollution so we can all breathe easier, and that's a huge, huge factor.
Absolutely. You're talking about 7 million deaths from air pollution every year, direct air pollution, particulate pollution, much of that from transportation, probably about 4 to 5 million. So even if you were to, in an ideal state, transform fully to electric transportation and remove those particulates, we would be much healthier as a civilization. We'd have less heart attacks, less strokes, less instances of lung cancer. And we would remove that particular harmful externality, which has been with us since the start of the Industrial Revolution. I think that electrification, okay, I'm going to come at this a little sideways. Do you know what the Latin word lucina means?
No.
Well, the Latin word lucina is the word for butterfly. But a butterfly doesn't start out as a butterfly. A butterfly starts out as a caterpillar and chews up leaves on trees and can cause a lot of harm as a caterpillar. But the caterpillar then goes through this state where it spins this cocoon around itself, and in order to survive, it has to transform. It has to become something else other than the worm that crawled over that tree and hurt that tree. And that's kind of the way I think of our energy system now. It's like kind of in the caterpillar stage. It's like thinking, well, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can like spin this cocoon around ourselves and do the hard work of turning into something else so that we can fly around and drink the nectar of electricity from the sunlight and the wind. And I think that's kind of the way we need to look at this is, we're not necessarily bad. We're just in this state, and survival calls for us to transform. You've heard of Extinction Rebellion, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and the young lady who's been such a speaker, Greta?
We've broadcast two of her speeches on this show. Ms. Thunberg.
Yeah, Greta Thunberg. So she was recently talking about how, approaching this as if you're building a cathedral and you build the foundation, but you don't yet know what the ceiling's going to look like. And you kind of have to have a little bit of that willingness to step out into the unknown to transform in that way. So, yeah, hopefully a good metaphor for your very salient earlier point.
I just want to wrap up with the thought of the difference between evolution and adaptation personally. Our society has made us so that we have to adapt to these technical changes that have come on so rapidly, the whole internet thing and everything. But sometimes we have to change our lives completely and take on new jobs. And many people in today's world have had four or five different careers because things keep changing underneath them. And I think we will have to adapt to climate change, but also we'll have to evolve as people into whole new fields that we didn't expect about ourselves. And I think you are a real model of that, Robert Marston Fanny, because you've done the whole science fiction thing. You've done the defense analyst thing. You became a blogger. Now you're a video blogger. How do you feel about those changes that you've gone through?
I think that it's weird. I guess I'm a person that kind of operates on my gut a little bit. For example, I grew up in a family that, and for many good reasons, did not like the military. But at the same time, I wanted to serve my country and learn what it was like to be a part of a culture that was entirely where there was no entitlement. Because I grew up in a I would say that my family was pretty entitled, to a certain degree. My grandfather was a lawyer, and the Preston family had like this long lineage going back through Virginia, and even on my dad's side, there was a good deal of a sense of entitlement there, and I wanted to pull myself back from that and live with America. And one of the ways that I could do that is join the military. Now, of course, I was also interested in threats and I wanted to learn more about the troubles of the world. And I saw that as a mechanism for that. So I was kind of, I had this feeling of personal need to change. And so I joined the military and it was not as I expected, not as everyone told me who were from the previous generation, who certainly had a very valid experience, but it was a different experience. What I experienced were my unit was full of people from Puerto Rico and the Philippines, and there were African Americans, and there were guys like me who were college students, and there were people from the country, and we all got together and we worked together and we accepted each other as brothers, and we got stuff done. And for me, that was a very positive experience. That that made me feel like, hey, you know, and I understand that there's this, you know, chain of command, you have to do what you have to do in the military, but ultimately everyone who joins now is a volunteer, and their motivation is to serve. And in and of itself, at the individual level, I think that's a very positive choice. And so I learned from that. And coming from that into the world, I just kept moving. I went to Jane's, and there at the time the big threats were terrorism and anthrax letters and all this worry about Chembio. And I ended up briefing the U.S. Postal Service on how to try and detect anthrax letters, because our expert didn't show up, and they said, well, you're an editor, you know the material. I was like, I'm not an expert. And they're like, well, just tell us what the book says. And so I told them what the book said. And so I moved on. And so each step for me has been something that has been internal, something that I felt that I needed to try, that I needed to do in the path of my life. And I don't know if other people have a similar drive that occurs with them as they confront the world and their environment and their life. But for me, each step has felt necessary. I don't necessarily know why. I don't. Maybe there is some set of sensory input that I'm getting, and so it's not. It feels rational when I look back, but as I'm doing it, it's more like, you know, like you're surfing on a wave, and the wave's going to change, and so you have to change direction as the wave changes.
You have totally described my life, and I really appreciate that. Now, we're going to have to wrap up, so Robert Fanny, give us the titles of a couple of your books, and then tell us where to find you communicating these days.
Okay, so I've written a book on sustainability called Growth Shock. I've written two fantasy novels under the series title Luthiel's Song. I'm working on a web novel right now, which is a pretty acerbic critique through parody of present politics and crises, and how sometimes leaders have been bad through the lens of modern fantasy. And you can find me at robertscribbler.com or on YouTube under my name, Robert Fanny.
Beautiful. We've been talking with Robert Marston Fanny, and I've been mispronouncing it all the way through here.
It's all right.
You will find tons of links to our previous interviews, which are still popular, and Robert's current online habitats in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Robert, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been fantastic.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.